Welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avergan, an emergency podcast of sorts, but a planned emergency. As we mentioned on Monday's show, we knew that Donald Trump...
Your father and I planned it. Yes. Don't believe your brother.
You say that with such specificity, it's as if you're recalling something from your own life.
Right? Absolutely not.
But we talked about on Monday's show about how we were going to discuss Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee, and now there is a Supreme Court nominee as announced by Donald Trump. We know that it is Neil Gorsuch, and here to discuss who he is and whether he'll get confirmed is our usual crew, Nate Silver, editor-in-chief. Hello, Nate.
Thank you. I'm happy to have joined in this emergency, time of emergency for this podcast.
It's
that was some fun syntactical.
Claire Malone, politics reporter. Hello, Claire.
Hi, Jody.
And here at the table with us is 538's Oliver Rader debut on the politics podcast. So Ollie writes about the Supreme Court and many other things and wrote that great Gorsuch profile that went up on the site late last night, right after the announcement. You wrote a version for all the main candidates?
That's right, yeah.
And then we just hit publish on Gorsuch.
The Gorsuch one was better. So
will you kind of like longingly go back and look at the other ones and be like, oh, what could have been?
Yeah, I put it on my fridge.
Yeah.
I printed it out.
And on the phone, joining us but on the phone, is WizKid Harry Enten, who is in – where are you, Harry? Can you hear me?
I am in Hanover, New Hampshire, home of Dartmouth College, and I apologize if my sound isn't great, but my spirits are high, and that's what's most important.
Yes. What are you guys, the Green Monsters? Something dumb like that?
We are the Big Green. We don't actually have a real nickname. I think they wanted to make us the Moose or something at some point.
So the answer is yes, something dumb like that. Okay, let's jump into it. We're going to do this relatively quickly, and I think kind of maybe in two parts. So we'll say who is Gorsuch and what do we know about him, and then we'll talk about what comes next with his confirmation and the rules in Washington. By the way, we are watching some of the confirmations that are coming down this morning, and speaking of changing rules and changing norms, we can kind of talk about that in a larger sense and in the way that some of the people who were confirmed this morning in D.C. But Claire and Ollie, let's have you take the lead on who is Gorsuch and his career on the bench. Claire, you want to give us the like I was trying to remember the name of that like encyclopedia that I had as a kid that had
Britannica?
Like 100 word. No, it was four kids and had like 100 word blurbs about like famous historical figures. So what's the
I only used real encyclopedias.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Well, give us the little sketch about what we need to know about
Neil. I think our first Supreme Court justice named Neil. I have not fact checked this, but I think it is true. Neil has what we might call a sterling pedigree. He also has sterling hair. It is white. Prematurely. He's very young. He's 49. And he is from the Wild West. He is based out of Colorado, born in Colorado, Boulder, I believe, but spent some formative years in D.C. His mother was an EPA chief for Reagan. And while he is Episcopalian, our first Protestant on the court for a while, he was Jesuit educated at Georgetown Prep, which I feel is important to say.
Do you think he's the most conservative person in Boulder, Colorado? Ollie, what do we need to...
Wait, I wasn't done.
Oh, you weren't done. Sorry,
yeah, we haven't even gotten to
There's
the academic
more.
Pedigree.
Oh, great.
Come on. I got to his high school, please.
Yeah, sorry.
Harvard, Yale, Oxford, but one of those British PhDs, which only take you 3 years mm-hmm. in the philosophy of law. Am I missing anything, Oliver, who got an American PhD?
One underreported detail, he did spend a summer at the University of Colorado at Denver, which I think is worth noting.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then it's been noted. Okay. So you guys can keep fleshing this out, but I'll jump in with what we need to know about his career and his judicial approach.
Right, so he is currently a judge on the U.S. 10th Circuit, a federal circuit covering a lot of the western states, including Colorado. He was appointed to his current position by George W. Bush in 2006. Was very easily confirmed by the Senate for his current judgeship. It passed in a voice vote. And so what we can kind of learn a little bit about the kind of Supreme Court justice he might be, given what he's done, of course, on the circuit court. So he hasn't weighed in officially, judicially, on many of the kind of big-ticket marquee cases that we might expect. the new court to take up over the next few years, but we do have some sort of hints. So a lot of his big decisions have revolved around religion. So he sided with Hobby Lobby in the Affordable Care Act case. Hobby Lobby took objection to providing contraception, and he sided with them. He's ruled against banning religious expression in public spaces, for example, displays of the Ten Commandments and things like that. One kind of big gap, at least in his on-the-record resume, is how he would rule on abortion issues. But there are hints. For instance, he wrote a book vehemently arguing against assisted suicide, using the argument that all human life is inherently valuable, and people are sort of reading the tea leaves of that book.
I have an on-the-fly correction.
Oh, yeah?
Even though Harvard and Yale slip off the tongue easily, he did go to Harvard for law school, but he went to Columbia for his undergraduate degree. But so, the three-year dinky Oxford PhD is...
So all the Columbia alums listening right now who are like in the middle of writing an angry email, you can pause on that. So, Ollie, on kind of placing him on the bench, you had a chart in your piece last night that I know a lot of people looked at, and you put Gorsuch on an ideological spectrum. Well, where did he land? Where do we expect him to land, and how does that metric get?
Yeah, so using the measures that we did, he would land somewhere just to the right of the space that was occupied by Antonin Scalia. So that would put him somewhere between Samuel Alito and Justice Clarence Thomas, who is sort of the far-right stalwart outlier on the court. And The scores that we used are called judicial common space scores, developed by political scientists and legal scholars. And they basically mash up a lot of different ways of quantifying ideology. So they use the ideology of the president who nominated the judge, George W. Bush in this case. They use the ideology of the nominee's home state senator, sort of an appeal to this idea of senatorial courtesy during the nomination process. And they use Supreme Court justices' actual votes and legislators' actual votes, and sort of combine all this information and put it in one sort of space, hence common space. And by that metric, we expect to see someone maybe just a little bit to the right of where Scalia sat.
You've written about this, and I think one of the big questions with Supreme Court justices is how they shift over time. So, I mean, we maybe have a sense of where he's starting, but is he, like Kennedy did, potentially going to shift back towards the center? Is there anything we can tell empirically or looking at his record that gives us an indication of how planted he is in that slot you just described?
Right. So you do get genuine surprises. Justice Souter, the former Justice Souter, is an example, nominated by George H.W. Bush, but became quite a reliable liberal voter toward the end of his career. And you do have a pattern that I've written about on 538 in the past, where justices get more liberal as they get older. There's this what's usually called judicial drift. So, none of this is perfect. There's, you know, typical statistical errors, but there's also just the evolution, natural evolution of justices' personal outlooks.
I'm actually interested in that idea of judicial lift. First of all, how do you sort of quantify getting more liberal, and are there any theories behind why it happens?
So they're quantified usually using something called Martin Quinn scores, which is similar to if listeners know the nominate score we use on the site occasionally. But basically they turn the series of basically for and against votes that justices make over the course of however many terms and turn those into kind of one single number on a kind of left-right spectrum. And then you can just kind of track over year by year, term by term, kind of how this number
and what about the psychology of it? Because isn't it a young man who's a conservative has no heart, but an old man who's a conservative has no brain? So it's interesting to me that it's sort of the opposite.
And there's all these theories about how it's also maybe if you move to D.C., and which is a fairly left-leaning
cocktail parties,
yeah. You're surrounded more by liberals.
Is that the only theory, the
That's
cocktail party?
One of the theories.
I think there's a few others. I think one is, which maybe used to operate more, was called the greenhouse effect, named not after the gases, but after Linda Greenhouse, the New York Times Supreme Court columnist who held sort of basically ripped apart conservative justices in her column. And the idea was that maybe they were subject, similar to at the cocktail party, to this sort of being criticized in the press.
I have a theory.
Yeah. Yes.
Coming up with this on the fly, right?
Really? Shocker.
But in a sense, I think conservative approaches to jurisprudence are more idealistic in a way. They're more rigid in a way. I don't mean that as a bad thing necessarily, right? But, you know, maybe as you go along, you become more pragmatic, mm-hmm. sort of. I don't know. But, like, yeah.
Okay. The reason I even brought this up is because there was another pick, Thomas Hardiman, who kind of people had thought was maybe more someone who would do this kind of drift or maybe had more of this. And I mean, and so this is Claire, and I want to bring Harry, bring you in on this as well. But when it comes to making this pick, and Trump said it last night, he said, you know, this is from the list that Trump had said he was going to choose from, and this is red meat to his base. I mean, this is a solid, super conservative pick, right? So in what way does this satisfy his voters and, I guess, the GOP establishment, if there's a difference between the two of those? Harry, do you want to start on that?
Yeah, I would say, look, this is the most conservative thing I think that Donald Trump has done so far in a traditional conservative sense, right? I think we can argue what exactly Trump's ideology is individually, but Gorsuch is a conservative in every sense of the word. Republicans have wanted a conservative justice on the court. They were very fearful of another suitor like Hardiman. They thought might be, though I would argue that Hardiman had much less of a chance than Souter had of shifting to the left. And I think that this is the type of pick that is going to be a home run with conservatives and with Republicans, but is not the type of pick that most Democrats will like, though I think most people who are involved in judicial circles, no matter their ideology, respect Gorsuch for his qualifications.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can just step in here and say of the conservatives who sort of applauded Trump's pick, there were sort of the regular people that you would expect, but also someone like John McCain, who's been highly critical. Rand Paul came out and said, good job. Ben Sasse, who's been the Republican senator from Nebraska, who's been a big Trump critic, said, tremendous pick. So this is all around sort of being applauded by movement conservatives in the base.
Okay, let's talk about what comes next. So, Harry, you want to take the lead here and how do you see the looming fight? And I think this is also where we have to mention Merrick Garland's name and the fact that this, you can't think of this moment without thinking of the larger context of what has happened over the last year and how Democrats are reacting to that and gearing up for this fight.
Right, exactly. I mean, there are basically two thresholds that Gorsuch needs to pass. The one that is the easiest is he needs to get at least 50 votes to be confirmed to the United States Supreme Court. There are 52 Republicans. Through my research and based upon what we know about Gorsuch, he is going to get that 50 votes unless there's something that comes out, you know, maybe had some nanny problem or something like that. He's going to get that. But the larger question is whether there are going to be 60 votes to end any filibuster and for cloture to be enacted. And that is a far more difficult threshold insofar as that although Republicans have 52 seats, they need 8 Democrats to reach 60 in order to enact cloture, and it's not clear at this point whether or not they're going to get 8 Democrats to vote for cloture, especially given Merrick Garland, where there was a nominee that Barack Obama put out, and Republicans wouldn't even hold confirmation hearings. So there are going to be a lot of voices on the left, a lot of interest group voices, a lot of voices from everyday Democrats who are going to say, you shouldn't give Republicans an inch. There's no reason you should vote for cloture because they gave us no respect and we want to play hardball just as they did.
Define cloture for us very quickly. That's basically forcing a vote.
Yeah, it's basically cutting off debate, forcing the vote, a yes or no vote, closing off the debate. And 60 votes is what you need right now. And if they don't get that 60 votes, if they continue to filibuster, if Democrats don't give that 60 votes, there is a decent chance that Republicans will use the quote-unquote nuclear option to force it so that no longer will it be that a Supreme Court nominee could be subjected to a filibuster where it will simply be a yes or no vote. And that's a possibility that is not a small one at this time.
And that's basically Mitch McConnell changing the rules on the fly in order to then be able to have this vote.
Correct. And remember, Democrats did the same thing for lower court justices, federal court judges who were not Supreme Court justices. They made it so those are yes or no votes. So it wouldn't be without precedent.
I mean, the notion of rules in the Senate have this whole kind of Calvin ball component to them, right? Where it's kind of not clear where the rules originate from, not clear what the constitutional basis of those rules might be. I mean, look, I think there are a couple of things that shouldn't be underestimated. One of them is how much pressure Democrats will be under from their base to not confirm this pick, to filibuster this pick, you know. On the other hand, I think people might underestimate, maybe ineffective is the wrong term or the right term, I'm not sure, right? But, like, the lack of a endgame strategy for Democrats, how much in the long run that hurts them, right? Like, if there were some alternative and they said, you have to pick this guy or this woman instead, right? Here's our list. Then maybe they would get somewhere, right? If they had kind of made it from the start about, hey, we need, this was an unusual circumstance, right? Merrick Garland was not confirmed. We think that was objectionable. We understand that Republicans won the Senate or maintained the Senate and won the presidency. They didn't win the popular vote, right? It's a very divided country. We need a centrist consensus pick, right? You know, that to me is somewhat effective messaging, but they kind of said, you know, there were reports beforehand that we're going to filibuster anyone, and they kind of walked that back and said we're going to filibuster no one. And it's like, you know, McConnell made this mistake too with Garland, although it didn't hurt him, obviously, right? But, like, you know, the smart politics of this is to wait for the nominee to be chosen and say, oh, well, that guy's unacceptable, right? Instead, they kind of, I don't know.
I think it's interesting. I think you bring up a really good point, Nate, which is, and it's the fact that Merrick Garland was a moderate nominee. They went out of their way to do that. And so the idea that it's kind of like the Rodney Dangerfield sparring of the Senate. There's, like, no respect, and the Democrats are kind of, like, looking to get some.
Yeah, but they don't really have, you know. But the fact was, at the end of the day, the GOP had leverage in the Merrick Garland fight because, at the end of the day, they just didn't have to confirm anyone. They controlled the Senate. They had the majority. So even if the nuclear option had been invoked, you know, Republicans are in control of the Senate. So at the end of the day, they did have more leverage, and also they had, you know, the fact that after 1 year you'd have a new president. There was a lot of risk to that strategy, by the way, right?
So, but what is the end game then, Harry? Is it all rules disappear and it's just pure Calvin ball and everyone gives up this fiction that rules exist? Or is it like make a moral case and try and find a consensus, as Nate put out? Or is it just basically like, do they get punished in the next election, or Fight Club, as Claire just pointed out? Those are your four options.
Well, Fight Club is always a fun option, okay, right? Yeah. I, as a member of a former Fight Club, you know, am a big believer in that. But, look, rules are schmools.
Just like they said in Fight Club, rules are schmools.
Yeah, rules are schmools. Look, rules are only as good as the people willing to uphold those rules. And we have entered in a time in our politics where moderation and coming together as one party or one body is no longer really something that people abide by. So I think the end game here is that Gorsuch is going to get confirmed. It's just a matter of how he's going to get confirmed. And I have no idea how that's going to be, but that would be my understanding. But keep in mind, look, we've had a lot of Supreme Court nomination hearings and a lot of votes, and we can very easily measure what's going to happen in a yes or no vote. It is far more difficult to understand what's going to happen in this situation where cloture will likely need to be invoked. And we just don't have the sample size that's necessary to understand how that's exactly going to go down or what's going to go down.
Ollie?
And I'm curious what my betters at this table make of this idea that, by all appearances, Gorsuch will restore the quote-unquote balance that was on the court before Scalia died, sort of four on the left, four on the right, one in the middle. And in some sense, the Democrats can sort of swallow this pill. But where they should wait to filibuster and really fight is if a liberal justice retires or dies.
I mean, look, the first part of it is a good talking point for Republicans. I think some measure of people will be persuaded that, hey, this guy was a conservative and therefore it's one for one swap, right? You know, I'm not sure I agree with that, but I think I recognize that argument is inherently somewhat persuasive. The latter argument that Democrats should hold their fire, I mean, that's BS, right? Because if you're kind of saying, I mean, the filibuster for SCOTUS barely even exists, right? It's like more of a, you know what I mean? It's more of an idea than an actual thing. And you know, the minute that they had to destroy it for the second or the third or the fourth nominee for Trump, then they they very well might do that, right? And so, you know, here's this thing that will take away from you the minute you challenge it, but you have to not break it, because then next time it's circular. It's like splitting tens in blackjack or something, right? We just kind of seems like not that bad an idea. We just kind of go around in a circle and never really get anywhere. So that argument is, I think, on the verge of being idiotic. If Republicans were to threaten to use to take away the filibuster for other types of legislation, now that's a more serious breach of precedent. I don't think that's on the table, but there are lots of things, certainly big parts of any Affordable Care Act replacement, right, where that filibuster would come in very handy to Democrats.
But I guess this is what I'm trying to figure out, is like, if you just keep drawing a line in the sand and then erasing it and drawing another line in the sand and erasing it. And just this morning we saw that the Senate Finance Committee suspended their rules in order to get Tom Price and Steve Mnuchin right through. So like, that may seem like one of these small, I don't know if that seems small or big, but it's like, I can't figure out. At some point, if you just go tit for tat for tit for tat for tit, then like everyone gets to claim that they are the
well,
tat.
Well, that's why if you're looking at a
tit,
if you're looking at a baseline case,
but everyone's the tit.
We've used a lot of tit here.
I think you're going to have 32 to 38 Democrats who are not going to vote for cloture, right? The Democrats are in the Senate. They're the minority, but it's actually a pretty blue minority now and a pretty liberal minority, right? And a lot of them are under threat from the base, aren't going to go anywhere near any vote for this guy, right? And then you have five from really red states, like Heidi Heitkamp, who I think would happily vote for cloture. But like, there's this kind of group in the middle, for example, maybe because she's come under some fire recently, like Dianne Feinstein and people like that, people who tend to, Bill Nelson of Florida, Mark Warner of Virginia, that are a little bit more moderate, right, who aren't likely, by the way, to be presidential candidates, is playing into this too, right? Any Democrat who wants to run for president will kind of down the line veto everything or vote against everything that Trump does. But, you know, I think that unless – this is the baseline prediction, very likely to be wrong in one direction or another. I think unless there is some better rationale for opposing Garland – for opposing
a lot of Democrats do too.
Yeah, for opposing this pick specifically, then I think the filibuster fails. That you have enough Democrats who maybe not even acting in their self interest. I think you're gonna see amazing pressure, enormous pressure from the base, right? But I think they'll have conversations and they'll say, we don't really have leverage here. We don't really have anything we're gonna accomplish by this, and so you kind of put on a good show, and then a few people kind of take one for the team. Maybe they're not at risk of a primary challenge, or they think it might do them some good in the general election, right? Maybe there's some notion of a deal with Trump, right? That they get something. I don't know. It's like the Knicks with Carmelo Anthony, right? The more you look at it, the more they don't really have any good hands to play.
But there is
changes, though. If there is something in Gorsuch's confirmation hearing, in his background, and look, politics matters here too, right? I would say the Democrats didn't play the politics of this very well, and I'm the guy who kind of hates this kind of, oh, let's look at the optics of this, right? But they didn't, on day one, have very good arguments that they were making, and they didn't seem very prepared, even though this guy was probably the most likely pick, right? But maybe they can come up with some better arguments. You know, right now, the ones they have, I think, are kind of discombobulated.
I think I've seen this idea of let's use this as a chance to get a deal, that argument emerging, which I think will be interesting to watch. So we got to wrap here. Harry, you got a final thought, and maybe even if you can talk a little bit about the role of public pressure here. We haven't talked about all the protests that are going on and all of that,
right,
and whether that plays at all a role or whether this is just a horse trading in the Senate thing.
A quick few things. Number one, I'm reminded of a line from the movie Recount, which was about the 2000 recount, where Ronald Klain, who was basically leading that recount, said to, I forget exactly who he said it to, but the fight is here and the fight is now. And that's the question that Democrats have to ask themselves, is when is the fight here and when is it now? And from Nate's sort of speaking, they may come to the agreement that the fight isn't here and the fight isn't now, that it's better to put it down the road. But at some point, they're going to have to put their stake in the lane and say, enough is enough. And I think one of the things that will kind of lead them to understanding whether or not it's a time to fight is how the public feels about the pick. And we know from the past that whether or not the public approves or disapproves of a nominee tends to explain a lot of the things or reasons why a nominee gets more votes than expected or less votes based upon their qualifications and their ideology. And so the thing that I'll be watching is whether or not Gorsuch is as well-liked as Trump, which is that is not well-liked at all, or whether he's as well-liked as the average nominee to the Supreme Court has been over the past 25 years. If it's closer to the latter, more like an average nominee, then I think it's going to be very difficult for Democrats to really put up too much of a fight in terms of cloture. If, however, this nominee is despised by the public, which I think is the less likely of the options, that's when I think the here and now fight will be.
All right. Ollie Rader, any last thoughts?
Yeah, something Nate touched on earlier, but it's unclear to me what the sort of counterfactual for the Democrats is in terms of alternate nominees. So Trump called this like the most transparent nomination process in the history of the Supreme Court, and at one point had a list, I think, of 21 potential nominees. But these nominees are heavily vetted and suggested by the Heritage Foundation, the Federalist Society, with the sort of explicit goal of not having another suitor, another sort of turncoat Republican justice. So it's unclear sort of what the counterfactual is if this gets fought.
Claire?
Yeah, I think just to Harry's point about public perception, I think this is probably one of the first concrete challenges for grassroots activists on the Democratic Party side of things to sort of if, you know, I think Gorsuch is kind of he presents a telegenic face to the world and, you know, sort of personifies kind of moderation that might belie something different, more conservative view. So I think it'll be a challenge of liberal organizing to sort of see whether they can sort of, you know, make Senate Democrats really feel the pressure.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Obviously, we will continue talking about this, but thanks for joining us on this emergency podcast. Ollie Rader, thank you.
Thanks, Jody.
And everyone should go read his piece on the site right now. Nate Silver, thanks.
Thanks, Jody.
Claire Malone.
Thanks, Jody.
And Harry, enjoy yourself up there.
I'm going to try my best
to enjoy. Is there snow?
There is snow. I was walking past. There were snow showers. There's snow on the ground. And I just have to add one thing, Mr. Avergan, is the Trump Picks Neil Gorsuch piece was co-written by somebody else besides Mr. Ali, and that is my
Was it Claire? Was it Claire? Yes,
yeah,
it was
Claire.
Yes,
it
I did clear. Notice that co-byline, but Ollie's name was first, and that's I just
I
stopped reading after
I would never share a
byline,
least of all with Ollie.
Hey, great job, Harry, on that piece.
Thank you so much. See, it's your confirmation that allows me to live my life to its fullest.
My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. Micah Cohen is 538's politics editor. Jorge Estrada and Tony Chow are in the control room. And our intern is Kara Chin. Get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. Ollie has @Ollie. I don't know how you scored that, but very easy to find. So if you want to ask him Supreme Court questions.
Yeah, I've been getting a lot of Bobcat tweets this week.
Who's Ollie the Bobcat?
I thought you were a
He escaped from
news
the National
man.
Zoo.
And people think he has Twitter?
People are disappointed when they find out I'm not the Bobcat.
Okay. Well, if you have a Supreme Court question and not a Bobcat-related question, tweet
Either's fine.
At Ollie. Maybe you'll field some Bobcat questions. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in iTunes. When you leave a rating, it helps our rankings, which helps others discover the show. A reminder that we are launching our new series on the future of the parties later this week, so check the feed
check
for that on Friday. Claire is co-hosting with
Galen Druk. You'll be well fed. It's a veritable feast this week.
It's a cornucopia of podcasts.
Gorge yourself.
An omakase course? Well, hey, Jody.
We're done with the show, Nate.
Do we want to... So Trump
I
said... Hold on one second. Yeah. Trump
Harry
said,
can hang up.
Trump told McConnell to go nuclear. Do we want to do anything on that or we're covered?
No, we're done. Okay. Thanks. Let me just say this last line. Thanks again for listening and we'll see you soon.